Good evening and welcome to the first public event of the Mediterranean Platform, which is organized in cooperation with the Ebele Research Center, Cultures of Europe in a Multipolar World, and the Center for Cultural Inquiry. The Mediterranean Platform is a collaborative interdisciplinary project that was launched in 2019 to pursue and promote the field of Mediterranean studies at the University of Constance. Since then, we have organized a series of talks and lectures. And when Daniel König, Ulrich Gotter, and I planned this workshop in the context of our preparation for a joint seminar on Mediterranean empires, we could not have imagined how virulent the question of rethinking imperial space would become, but unfortunately, Vladimir Putin arranged for it. Due to Corona, this conference had to be postponed. We are very happy that not only the active participants, but also our two keynote speakers remained loyal to us and came to Constance 1 year later as Ebele Fellows. Both of them actually need no introduction, but for those in the room who do not know them so well yet, I will try to do so. Jane Burbank is a major historian of modern Russia. She's a professor emerita of history and Russian studies at New York University. She's the author of two monographs, Intelligentsia and Revolution, on Russian intellectuals and their views of Bolshevism in the period of the revolution, and Russian peasants go to court, on legal culture in rural Tsarist Russia. She has also published a number of influential edited volumes that have changed the image of Russia and the Soviet Union, such as on the relationship of perestroika with Soviet culture and on Tsarist and early Soviet Russia as empires. Since the first Ukrainian war in 2014, she has published on Eurasianism and on this occasion, most recently published a widely noticed and highly acclaimed article in the New York Times, offering a genealogy of Eurasianism from the interwar period to the present war in Ukraine. This shows that she's not only a historian, but also a public intellectual who intervenes publicly and undergoes the sometimes challenging, sometimes painful dialogue with the media. Frederick Cooper is a professor emeritus of history at New York University. He is an eminent historian of modern Africa, who has published monographs on labor history and labor movements and on the history of decolonization. He has developed the theory of the gatekeeper state. According to this theory, African states are weak in establishing order internally, but strong in regulating and taking advantage of the external relations of African societies. At the same time, he has redefined the theoretical field of colonial studies and co-founded what has been called the new imperial history, demanding that metropole and colony be treated within a single analytical framework. This demand has transformed our approach to imperial history. Whereas previous approaches strictly separated overseas and continental territories, this new approach transformed imperial history into a new global history of relations and interaction between metropoles and colonies. This driving role in the booming field of global history has not prevented him from sharply criticizing globalization as a concept too closely linked to modernization theory with its teleology of progress, thus representing a kind of updated version of modernization theory under the sign of neoliberalism. Together, Jane and Fred published the seminal volume Empires in World History, Power and the Politics of Difference. This is a world history of empires from antiquity to modernity, translated into numerous languages. It highlights the ability of empires to manage cultural difference and emphasizes that empires represent the rule rather than the exception in world history, whereas the nation-state long considered the telos of history in the perspective of modernization theory only appears as, I quote, a blip in the historical horizon. From this longue durée perspective, current constellations of conflict, even in the Mediterranean, for example, the recent economic and military engagement of China, Russia, Turkey, and the Gulf states, become understandable. Lucky for us, Jane and Fred have embarked on a new collaborative book project, which is still in the making, but will deal with post-imperial phenomena without actually forming a sequel to Empires in World History. And we are, of course, very curious to know what this book will be about and how it fits into the explanatory models they've developed so far. Since the Mediterranean is a contact zone of empires between and across Africa, Asia, and Europe since antiquity, Jane and Fred are predestined to open our workshop on trans-Mediterranean perspectives on imperial space with their keynote. And we are very excited how you can help us to understand this topic and how you present together. And we thank you very much for your that you accepted our invitation.
Well, thank you very much, Manuel, for this opportunity and for the invitation to come to the University of Konstanz. I also want to thank all those people who have made our stay so far so pleasant. We are Eberle Fellows, but as you've heard, we're very impressed by the collaboration among institutions here. The Mediterranean Platform, the Center for Cultural Inquiry, the History Department. We're very happy to be guests of all of you. And I just want to single out a few people who have been so helpful to us. Heidi Engelman, Jovo Miladinovic, Maria Kuberg, and Andreas Guidi. So thank you very much. And this presentation will be in two parts. I will speak at the beginning and then Fred will take over partway through. So the essence of empire is the extension of power across space and cultural difference. Empires make connections over long distances and among unlike societies. But they also break and prevent connections as imperial leaders try to organize economic and political life along vertical relations to their centers of power and to impede horizontal relations among incorporated territories. Imperial connections are asymmetric, often conflictual. Extending power means coming to grips with space as it actually existed, in a geographical sense, but also a political one. That is, as space had been configured by earlier and ongoing politics. A growing empire had to establish itself and maintain its authority over terrains as unlike as steppe, desert, forest, field, spaces crossed by mountains and rivers, over seas, oceans, and islands. Geography shaped possibilities for expansion or for defense of existing domains of control. Expansion, in turn, reshaped spatial relations, not only for the expanding empire, but for other political entities. In our talk today, we want to emphasize the intersection of space and empire as dynamic and interactive. Space, in its particular physical and political configurations, can make imperial formation possible or difficult. It can impact the ways that empires are configured and sustained. At the same time, the actions of empires can reshape space, both physically and sociologically. Empires' actions can impact the environment, the relations between urban and rural areas, the architecture and arts that delineate spaces. Cities may prosper or decline under imperial power. Ports may flourish or decay as empires restructure trade routes. Borders between polities may be established or destroyed. New states, dependencies, local configurations of power may emerge or vanish as empires connect or disconnect discrete spaces from each other. In other words, space, location, imprints empires, and empires transform space. But between the spaces on which an empire takes shape are the connections that link spaces and empires to each other. Imperial policies can establish new connections, inhibit old ones, enhance the possibilities for the movement of people, goods, resources, and ideas, or constrain that movement. The exploitation and management of connections, like that of fixed space, requires certain things of empires. Physical and social connections are vulnerable to the actions of empires and their contestations. And in this sense, empires make and remake the so-called worlds of connected spaces, even as these worlds present challenges to imperial control. So I turn to the question of typologies. A conventional approach to the relationship of space and empire was to draw a distinction between land-based and sea-based imperial projects. This notion was used commonly in the 20th century when the colonial empires of Europe came into academic focus. The maritime empires were the European colonial powers with their overseas components. The land-based empires were thought of as the outmoded continental ones, Russia, the Ottoman Empire, Austro-Hungary, China. There were many problems with this typology. Among them, its occlusion of imperial projections inside Western Europe, its distinctions between modern and backward empires, and its neglect of the obvious land and sea connections of the empires in question. We will return to this last point shortly. Curiously, or maybe not, the land versus sea empire typology has reemerged in recent years and in the context that matters to all of us, as Manuel suggested. The major ideologue behind Putin's war on Ukraine, Alexander Dugin, has revived Harold Mackinder's heartland versus sea power dichotomy, a dichotomy that Mackinder proposed in an article published in 1907. Dugin uses this typology to describe Russia's land empire as threatened by the sea-oriented Atlantic powers. In Dugin's account of political history, the United States, with its worldwide sea power, is the eternal enemy of Russia, whose power is based, as we see here, on a Eurasian terrestrial core. Dugin's theory is decidedly spatial, and his aim, the reconquest of Ukraine, for starters, is to enlarge the space of Russian empire. Let's take a different approach to the question of land and sea space. The patterns of expansion of empires from ancient times to the present do not fit the conventional distinction between overseas and terrestrial empires. Rome was both a land and sea power, an empire that extended across the Mediterranean and across the landmass of Western Europe. The Roman Empire's spatial limits were both geographical and political. The Alps, the mountains and desert edge of North Africa, as well as the human obstacles of Germanic tribes and Persian political formations. To take another example, the Umayyad Caliphate. After its formative decades in Arabia and the Eastern Mediterranean, expanded with impressive rapidity across North Africa with its relatively sparse and fragmented populations into Iberia and to the, as well as to the east. Initially, a core of Arab conquerors did not intrude far into local societies. Later, incorporation, coerced or otherwise, and conversion to Islam enabled a deeper consolidation. The spread of Islamic empire also produced dangers to its coherence, both in North Africa, where new polities arose with leaders who also professed Islam, and in the eastern periphery, from which a new dynasty eventually took over the earlier core and established the Abbasid Caliphate. Islamic empire spawned networks of scholars and merchants who sometimes crossed imperial lines, sometimes reinforcing the power of emperors, sometimes subverting them. The imperial formation that came closest to the land and sea reach of Rome was that of the Ottomans, whose flexible repertoire of ruling practices reshaped the Eastern Mediterranean and adjacent terrestrial and maritime spaces over many centuries. So now let's think about overland empires. A focus on empire and space allows us to put land and sea together, but also to observe that land can pose the same problems and possibilities to empires as the sea. Control over long-distance trade routes and the challenge of connecting nodes of exchange and production were at the heart of empire making over the great spaces of deserts, steppes, and riverbeds internal to continents. The Sahara and the Amazon both supported trade and social connections from ancient times. An enticing region for empire builders was the Eurasian steppe. Eurasia offers empires the opportunity to exploit both the steppe's long-distance transport possibilities and its fungible, vulnerable proximities to productive civilizations on the region's edges, namely, notably, China. The region's highly dispersed populations, with their various local belief systems, and the area's particular resource endowment, favored the ambitions of leaders who could incorporate local authorities and federate enough military might to control long-distance trade in products extorted from settled polities and their concentrations of wealth. This space then, and this is Eurasia about 600 AD, was an ideal environment for empires constructed by nomads, with their ability to organize long-distance movements of people and goods. Over time, ambitious nomads, their clans, tribes, and federations produced multiple empires based on the steppe, the Xiongnu, the Turkic empires, the Bulgars, and of course, the Mongols. Genghis Khan put together the largest land empire in world history so far. His success depended on meeting the physical and political requirements for sustaining control over our particular space and its inhabitants. And his achievement would impact political and environmental endeavors for the next centuries, now almost 1,000 years. So let's connect maritime and continental history, and this will be the major part of our talk. In the 13th century, Mongol leadership of intersecting khanates across Eurasia, from Crimea to Beijing, fostered the revival and enhancement of trade between Western Europe and China. Two Mongol institutions, the Yam system of nodal stations along the so-called Silk Routes, and the licensing system that reduced competition and risk. These institutions enabled merchants to enormously increase their profits from trade in coveted goods. Like other imperial powers, the Mongols used both force and law to control lucrative commercial relations and keep others out of them. The Pax Mongolica transformed the Black Sea, the enclaves of Kaffa and Tana, Genoese and Venetian, respectively, into flourishing sites for the export of slaves, fish, caviar, animals, and other products, and the import of precious goods, spices and silk among them, from the east. The directions for export were not just east-west. Products traveled from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean and its ports. What mattered for the expansion of long-distance economy was Mongol management, taxation, regulation, monopolistic licensing conducted by Mongol authorities over a huge space. The wide-ranging impact of a cross-continental imperial system brings us to a consideration of connections beyond and across empires. Here in Konstanz, as we toured the city last week, Kirsten Malke described the outburst of economic activity stimulated by the opening of long-distance trading possibilities in the 13th century. Cloth production of a kind Mongols like, linen and cotton combined, flourished right here in Konstanz. This moment of connection, enabled by an imperial conquest, enriched merchant families who later used their wealth to negotiate other licenses with their other imperial overlord, their Habsburg overlord. At the beginning of the 16th century, Konstanz merchants acquired their own colony in South America, thanks to their wealth and ties to the Habsburg Emperor, a Konstanz-Venezuelan connection, we could say, generated by the politics of patronage and resource monopoly characteristic of empire. The connections enhanced or established by empires enabled transport of ideas as well as goods. These routes were not unidirectional. They enabled multiple actors to reconfigure or reimagine their relations within or over space. Konstanz and nearby Reichenau Island remind us of the connections forged by and in the Holy Roman Empire, linkages embodied in monastic networks and the interlaced, layered sovereignties of local and imperial lords. The spread of Christianity from Byzantium and of Buddhism from South Asia are partly linked to imperial expansion, partly to networks that went off in their own directions. While the link between Christianity and political power was strong in Western Europe, with rival aspirants to power laying claim to Christian legitimacy, the Mongol empires to the east were notable for their religious eclecticism. The Mongol approach was to recognize the diversity of religious and social practices in their empire and to draw religious specialists into their entourage, thus enhancing their legitimacy as imperial overlords. This pluralistic kind of imperial culture was both essential for the sustenance of empire over the huge Eurasian space, and it shaped the political cultures of societies in this enormous area well after the end of Mongol rule. Land, sea, and dynastic power were in interaction with one another as human history became more global, literally, in the 16th century. The Habsburg dynasty, sustained through multiple manipulations of marriage and family lineage, expanded over land, but not contiguous land, into parts of what is now the Low Countries and parts of France, parts of Spain. The discontinuities of the Habsburgs' domains extended the dynasty's connections across Europe, but left it vulnerable to attempts to escape or usurp its diffused authority. The political obstructions in European space, combined with the Ottomans' blockage of land and sea routes to the east, spawned one of the great overseas imperial extensions, accidentally located in the Americas. The Habsburgs struggled over a long time against the centrifugal threats of its diversified political geography, as well as against the envious assaults of rival empires, Ottoman and British most notably. The conquistadors' American venture took the form it did. not because the Americas were empty territory, but because a prior history of empire building, Aztec and Inca, had concentrated wealth that made it worthwhile for conquest to continue. The silver and gold of the Americas in turn lubricated European trade with East and Southeast Asia, which had more to offer in exports to Europe than Europe had to offer to Asia. Silver from the Andes was, in the 16th century, finding its way to much of East Asia. The British Empire had its own roots, both in land, via the difficult task of incorporating Scotland, Wales, and the nearby island of Ireland, and overseas. It both fought the Mughal Empire in South Africa and also made use of the Mughals' networks and legitimacy to insert British power on the subcontinent. The intruding British power, with its superiority in managing long-distance maritime connection, relied on Indians for much of its finance as well as production. The British intrusion reconfigured but did not end the patchwork of differentiated and layered sovereignty in South Asia. It eventually resulted in more combinations and divisions in the political space of the region. One can cite other examples. Once the Netherlands separated from Habsburg rule, its elites, with their bases in several Dutch cities and commercial networks, found their great sources of wealth halfway across the globe in the East Indies. What has often been described as the expansion of Europe was in actuality a complex interplay of European and Asian empires with different spatial configurations. In the Far East, the consolidated and productive Chinese Empire was connected to political entities and dynamic commercial diasporas across Southeast Asia. In Europe, the Ottoman Empire controlled land routes to the east and the Red Sea, blocking European access to the lucrative zones in the Indian Ocean and Southeast Asia. And now Fred is going to continue.
Let me add my thanks to that Jane provided to the all the organizers and all the people who helped the organizers of this workshop. The Atlantic economy from the 16th to the 19th century was dramatically and tragically shaped by commerce and slave-produced commodities. It was a nexus of empire and long-distance connection that made this economy possible. The islands and coastal plantation areas where sugar was produced were vulnerable to attacks of other empires. Some changed hands in the course of imperial competition. Another threat was internal. Slave owners lived in fear of slave revolt. They needed the backing of a military force with long reach. They needed to build such a force. The need to build such a force lay behind the creation of what John Brewer has called the fiscal military state of Great Britain. This was a state focused on empire, capable in turn of using force to gain a competitive edge over other trading empires and to enforce its rule at home and abroad. Britain's leading role in the development of industrial capitalism was promoted by pushing the opportunity costs of feeding workers onto land taken from people in the Americas using labor taken from Africa. The dynamic that produced what Kenneth Pomerantz calls the Great Divergence, England versus China, was not nearly evident until well into the 18th century. Western European hegemony was based on the ability to coordinate domestic development with relations to different parts of the world and the capacity, naval above all, to inhibit the encroachment of others on the lengthy but narrow pathways that connected the domains of action. This spatial nexus drew resources from spaces outside the British imperial system, indeed outside of European and any European empire. That is, from West and West Central Africa. The Atlantic trade was connected to empire building by Africans, first from networks that spun off from the great Mali and Songhai empires of the 15th and 16th centuries. The slave trade then fostered African empire building. In the cases of Asante and Dahomey, for example, in which a small elite's control of access to external markets enabled it to concentrate wealth and power in its own hands. These African empires were land-based, with considerable territory and significant populations under their control. But they were dependent on their links to the sea and its trading advantages, and to raiding territories beyond what they controlled. By capturing slaves from beyond the empire's edge and selling them abroad, the slave trading empires externalized the costs and the risks of its wealth gathering without having to extract surplus from its own population. The process led both to conflict among African polities and to competition for slaves among European empires, which fostered further development of a slave trading infrastructure and wars on African soil that generated more slaves. Atlantic expansion is an inter-empire, cross-continental story. So too is the ending of the slave trade, a project of the British Empire, which pressured other powers to follow its lead, and which in later phases turned into a justification for intervening in Africa. But the underlying causes of the partition of Africa, a literal carving up of space, was rivalry among European empires, a dynamic that changed after 1870 with German unification and its entry into the global empire game. The rapid carve-up was largely preemptive, as each imperial power tried to ensure there would not be fall victim to another empire's monopolization of trade relations with export-rich areas of the continent. But once territory was appropriated, once it was claimed and other empires kept out, none of the conquering powers invested very much in developing it for another half century. The agreement reached at the Berlin Conference of 1884-1885 over the rules of the partition game was a step towards defining Europe as a zone where rules of interaction among empires could be worked out, the Europeanization of colonialism, one might say. Although this process ended in disaster in 1914, it did much to deepen a civilizational, indeed racial, distinction between Europe and Africa that has proven very hard to overcome. In an ideological sense, the Mediterranean separating Europe and Africa became wider as means of transport and communication made the physical distance shorter. Summing up this kaleidoscopic glimpse at empires and their extensions over both land and sea, we note that both virtual and physical spaces were transformed by the power of empires to disrupt, co-opt, and exploit existing political and economic arrangements. At the same time, imperial connections across space could enhance the possibilities for local actors and enable the transmission of ideas. Both phenomena could either enhance or spell trouble for the imperial power. Let me turn to a different way of looking at this picture, what we might call a deep history of global nodes, a way of thinking about empire in space that is less concerned with empire as a territorial entity, more with the relationship of parts of each empire to other spaces, to other polities. Sandra Halperin has argued for the deep historical roots of the idea of global cities that some scholars insist was a late 20th century phenomenon, that wealth is concentrated in a few great cities, linked more closely economically to each other than their respective national territories, enhancing core periphery, urban rural, rich poor differentiation, and tension within producing tension within North American Europe as much as in Asia and Africa. Halperin takes the argument back to the city-states of ancient Greece and their colonies around the Mediterranean, and argues that even when later empires established control over territory, the crucial economic relations were between cities within those territories, their dependencies, and other cities within or beyond the empire. And one might illustrate this with this chart about the population of what was first a Portuguese and a Dutch imperial city, Malacca in Southeast Asia, where you see the convergence of different peoples in a single city space. The extension of imperial power across the space of the globe concentrated wealth not so much across the imperializing state as in its port cities, leading to industrial development in and around them that further concentrated wealth. Halpern goes so far as to argue that the only time when national territory became more closely integrated than global cities to each other and the subordinated peripheries was between the 1940s and the 1970s. In this interval, the World War and its aftermath required national mobilizations and therefore redistribution of income across national territories. At the end of this nationalizing period, the turn to economic liberalism, she argues, brought back the reconcentration of wealth within the global cities framework. Halpern's city-state model is too schematic to account for the complexities of rural, urban, and intercity relations around the world over a period of 2,000 years. But it does suggest some important questions. It helps to explain the rise in recent decades of right-wing populism in such countries as Turkey, France, and the United States, based in rural areas and secondary cities, fed by a politics resentment against worldly urban elites and their connections with each other. It puts a particular accent on the historical importance of the port city and its ambiguous relationship to national and imperial political structures. Is the impetus behind the British Empire more Liverpool, Bristol, and London than the British Isles? Is French imperialism more about Bordeaux, Nantes, and Marseille than a Paris-centered French state? We look forward to Manuel's paper on this subject. Halpern's argument will lead us to put special emphasis on city-hinterland relations in both metropolitan and colonial contexts, on the power struggles and social dynamics that the growth of imperial commerce induced. It suggests that we give more attention to rivers that made it possible for port cities to be located inland, making rivers and valleys the focus of conflicting claims. It undermines the argument, which we think was wrong to begin with, that the nature of empire changed fundamentally in the 19th century when taking colonies became a project of consolidated nation states. Halpern's description of the national interlude of the middle 20th century might also help us understand the shorter term transformations of imperial power in the 1940s and 1950s. The politics of welfare and redistribution on a national scale after the war occurred at the same time when Britain and France, because of World War II, realized that their coercive power in the colonies had been weakened. Keeping the colonies would have required another approach, that is, extending welfare politics to them. This issue encouraged leaders to think of alternative ways of fostering their economic interests than the maintenance of colonies, raising the question of how economic inequality on a global scale has been reproduced even after the end of colonial empires. To rethink the relationship of empire and space is also to rethink the relationship of empire and time. Empire was future-oriented. Spatial expansion implied a future that was grander than the present, just as the present was grander than the past. Lurking behind the self-aggrandizing vision was a fear of its opposite, that the very extensive, hence diverse, constitution of the empire put it at risk of fragmentation. Fear of degradation, think of all the moralizing renditions of the fall of Rome, was part of the imperial mindset. Now, in an ideal, typical sense, national time is different. The idea of a single people on a single territory, that is the core of nation-state ideology, implies that a given people have a common past, a common present, and a common future. The nation moves more or less intact through time. Of course, the empire-nation-state distinction is more complicated in practice than in theory, and similar anxieties about the future beset imperial and national polities. Indeed, the distinction between national and imperial states is fragilized in different ways. States that claim to represent nations may resort to colonial strategies in the face of the realities of their mixed and unequal populations, and they may develop their own imperial ambitions. Imperial states might make themselves more national by assimilating, eliminating, or marginalizing diverse parts of the societies they incorporated. Challenges to empire reconfigure time as well as space. Anti-colonial movements looked to a future in which space would be politically reorganized, an aspiration toward an after, distinct from the before. But that opened the question of whether the after was all that different from the before. The question of when decolonization occurred, if it did, remains open. Scholars of Latin America, where empire formally ended 2,000 or so years ago, have popularized in recent years the term decolonial as a successor to postcolonial and neocolonial. The decolonial concept makes a point about the many dimensions of power relations that may not have changed with the formal end of colonial empires, but it obscures the multiple dimensions of the struggles and changes that have taken place over the intervening decades or centuries, writing generations out of history. It is not only colonial empires whose time is in question. China and the United States act imperially while claiming to have transcended empire. This year, Russia confronts us with the brutal reality that empire is not over. Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine is justified as a restoration of Russia's imperial grandeur. His reference to the past is specific as well as threatening. Exalting Peter the Great's expansion of Russia in a speech of June 9th this year, Putin claimed that Peter's 18th century victory in the Baltic region was only returning space that had always been Russian to his empire. Putin has used the same claim about the Crimea, alleging that this peninsula has been Russian even at the time of the Scythians and Huns. This radically falsified and illogical history makes Russia into an eternal imperial presence. It's an extreme example, but a frightening one, of an imperial leader claiming that a space simply belongs to an empire and does so across time. The relationship of time and space in a world after the formal end of colonial empires is complicated, though, in another sense, by the movement of people across the borders that now define, in international law and common parlance, the spatial order of the world. There is a large-scale migration from Turkey to Germany, from North Africa to France, from Mexico to the United States, to cite only a few examples. And this by people who seek employment, not necessarily a new home. For some of them, time is cyclical. Time away from home, time back home. The rhythms of life in these contexts, the way time is perceived, may be quite distinct. For refugees, the relationship of time and space is fraught. Whether exile will be temporary or permanent, how to deal with the problem of inclusion and exclusion in a new society, how much to stay involved in the politics of the place that had been abandoned. We are suggesting how much the relationship of space and time, empire and nation, remain uncertain. The transformations of the half century after World War II seem to promise a world of equivalent space, defined by sovereignty, a seat in the United Nations, a flag. The reality is that power over space, including that defined by sovereignty, is in question, violated by such existing states as Russia and by would-be cross-cutting powers such as organized Islamic Jihad fighters. Continental space, Europe versus Africa, still embodies stereotypes and invidious distinctions. The existing structure of territorially defined states is challenged both by imperial and anti-imperial ideologies. As students of the region around the Mediterranean know better than anybody, interconnection across space is nothing new, even if the rapidity of communications has changed. Nor are such interconnections unique to this region, even if their rapidity and density varies greatly with geographical and social conditions. Studying empires around the world underscores both the extent and the limitations of connections across space. Although the reach of an imperial power might extend literally across the globe, think of the Netherlands-Dutch Indies connection of the 17th century, those connections can be as narrow as they were long. They were constrained by geography and the technical limitations of getting across or around mountains and oceans. They were limited by the extent to which people whom imperial rulers encountered had developed their own political capacities and their own networks that could resist or deflect the imperial intrusion, and empires were constrained by each other. This is why both the global and the ization in globalization are misleading. We need to approach empires and connections across space without overestimating empires or romanticizing connections. We cannot forget that connections, more often than not, were asymmetrical, reflecting and exacerbating unequal relations of power. Similar considerations should shape the way we approach the study of the people whom expanding empires encountered and tried to subordinate. To take seriously their social, political, and cultural specificity without reifying their particularity. For they, too, were the products of connection and conflict in a distant and recent past. The study of empire, of place and connections, of particularity and cultural mixing, of power and its limitations, all this should go together. And with this in mind, and this map from the 18th century in front of you, we'd like to conclude this lecture, and we're more than happy to entertain questions, comments, and discussion. Thank you for your attention.